losing Soto in game two of this series, what have you seen from just the depth of this roster in these three games?
Special. We got good players up and down. Dealing with few guys there with injuries, and you still feel really good with not only the guys that are in the lineup or are getting the opportunity to play more, but what's on the bench as well. And we saw it today. There's a lot of versatility. There's a lot of things that we could do because of the flexibility. But it goes to show you that it's a deep roster. It's a deep roster, and it's fun.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, April the 5th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join me at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, interact with me, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network, a great network of shows over there, for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast that comes to you here late on this Sunday. Mets just finished taking 3 out of 4 from the Giants out in San Francisco. Their first, I guess, mini West Coast trip of the season. It really wasn't. They went to St. Louis, then San Francisco, but it's their first stop west. If you remember when we analyzed the schedule earlier in the year for those who are extra inning subscribers, the Mets, they don't go west after about June 5th or 6th. So this is the first of a few trips to the West Coast here early in the season, a successful trip. And, you know, a week ago, who would have thought about the grinder that Mets fans were going to be through? And I could tell you, when we get to the mailbag, I have a couple of emails that maybe are dated a little bit, or a couple of comments that are dated a little bit since the Mets won 3 in a row here in San Francisco. But Mets fans for this first week of the season have been through the grinder. They had that tough loss last Sunday with the third base coach sending Lindor, tough loss to the Pirates, the first stick-to-your-ribs loss of the season, didn't take long. They go to St. Louis, they allow 7 runs, which should have been a dominant sweep to the Cardinals, but the Mets lose 2 out of 3. They lose in excruciating fashion. The business person special on Wednesday, not able to score a couple of times in extra innings. That's really hard to do with the ghost runner. And Lindor not hitting, Bichette not hitting, Polanco not hitting. And as you head into San Francisco after that loss, and then with the very lackluster start by David Peterson and Sean Manaea and his 89-mile-an-hour fastball saving the bullpen, but not impressing, there are a lot of shades of 2025. And then let's even add another one to the mix here. Their best hitter, one of the best offensive run creators in the game, Juan Soto, out with a calf injury. Looks like it's minor. But, I mean, you didn't have all this on your bingo card week one. So I can't really criticize the fans for yelling about firing Mendoza, comparing the team to 2025. David Stern's taking a beating on social media. And that's why it's really good. And I got to be honest with you guys, for the last maybe 3-4 days, I took a step back from social media. I took a step back in general. Watch the games on replay, actually. I said, let me take a step back. Let me put the emotions aside. Let me, you know, late night games, let me watch the games the next day, just to kind of look at it a little bit more like an analyst. It does a lot. And to do it this early in the season is odd, but I thought it would do a lot to kind of step outside some of the chaos. And look, when you add in throughout the last couple of, last week or so, the Yankees off to a great start. There's still some of that Nimmo Alonso watch going on. It was really hard to be a Mets fan this first week. But guess what? As I come to you, whether you're listening here very late Sunday night or early Monday morning or sometime during the first day off that the Mets have unless you want to count the day after opening day, which I don't. This is the first real day off in the schedule the Mets have. The Mets, as of today, are on a 97-win pace. Think about it. After all the garbage I just outlined, all the struggles, the offense being feast or famine, their best offensive player hurt, all sorts of things going on here, that terrible series in St. Louis, all the shades of 2025 that you saw through the first six or seven games, the Mets are on a 97-win pace. And I'll tell you what, they're not really showing signs about being the 2025 Mets. The only reason that you think they're the 2025 Mets is because they lost a couple of games here early that reminded you of last season. And I think that that second half, the stench of that second half, where they're one of the worst five teams in baseball, that's something they're going to have to work really hard to get away from. And it's going to take some time, and it might take the first 2 months of the season and a really good start to wipe that away, because the fans still have that stuck to their ribs. That was a really disappointing, hard way of ending the season. And I think one of the things, and this was something that I was concerned about when Cohen took over the team, and going all the way back to the early days of Cohen, before the Mets even played a regular season game with him as the owner, when they got access to money, the fan base, when the fan base got rid of the Wilpons, I think a lot of them felt the money and the resources and the desire of this owner, even being compared to a modern day George Steinbrenner, I think they thought that all the problems of what a baseball team encounters, all the history that's water under the bridge with this franchise, was just going to disappear magically, because it's not. You still have to build a roster. You still have to deal with injuries. You still have to deal with the ups and downs of baseball season. Not every prospect, even with a wealthy owner, is going to work out. Not every free agent signing is going to work out. No roster is perfect. Not even the Dodgers, who now Mookie Betts is out and injured. And with some of their age, who knows how large their window is, how open their window is. And I think that that's creating some frustration. Here, the fans look. They have arguably one of the best executives in the game, or one who came with a lot of hype. Nobody objected to the Mets hiring him. The owner with the most money in the game. You want to argue the Dodgers, who are an equity group, but as an individual owner, he has the most money in the game. They see a window shrinking with the possible CBA coming in and restricting either via cap or some penalty at a certain spending level, restricting roster movement. So, you know, a lot of the fans, I think, see this as a temporary nirvana when it comes to just spending to get whatever you want. And the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much money you have. The baseball season is going to have ups and downs. Now, when you look at why this is not 2025, there's a lot of reasons in front of you. Even before the last three games against the Giants, to see how things are trending differently and in a really positive way that should make you hear, as we've cracked the cellophane now, our first 10-game stretch of the season now complete. So you have a little bit of a feel of this team. Very small sample size, but a little bit of a feel. The starting pitching has been really good. You want to know how good it is? Again, fun with numbers, small sample size. Expected ERA, the Mets are top 10 in the sport here. And that's just for the bullpen. You want to look at the starting pitching. Starting pitching wins, win shares, the Mets are sixth. Expected ERA, the Mets are seventh when it comes to starting pitching. Overall, when you take both the starters and the relievers and you mix them in, the Mets are a top 10 staff when it comes to win shares. With expected ERA, the Mets are a top 10 staff. So right now, the Mets starters and their bullpen are completely reversed. The starters, some of the worst in baseball in the second half. The bullpen, a complete walk-a-thon. They're actually, as a staff, a skush below league average on walks. There's still some walks coming out of that bullpen. Luke Weaver, Devin Williams. But when you look at Tobias Myers, when you look at Huascar Brazoban, when you look at how, for the most part, this staff has been able to navigate games with very little base runners via the free pass, that's a big change. And to me, that might be the most significant change. And I talked about this over at Extra Innings around the week, that one of the most impressive things I've seen so far this season when they won in the first game in St. Louis is how they navigated, once Senga came out of the game, how they navigated the bullpen without walking anybody. I mean, it's great. And when you think about the starting rotation, which started all this, which was the pain point. I mean, when you look at how the starters have pitched, look at how Senga has pitched well, kept them in games, and how Clay Holmes and even Nolan McLean, who admittedly through his first two starts has not had his best stuff. I mean, think about this. The guy doesn't have his best stuff. And you know, where does he sit right now? A 2.61 ERA, a 157 ERA plus. You know, he's 1-0. Had a perfect game. I mean, here he is saying he doesn't have great stuff. He had a perfect game through five against the Giants. Now, granted, they have not played stellar competition. Maybe the Pirates are, I shouldn't say that. The Pirates are actually playing well, and I think they're going to be better, especially because of their pitching. But St. Louis is in a rebuilding mode. I'm not so sure about the Giants. The Giants might be one of those teams that just put a bunch of veterans together, hoping to get that last gasp of good baseball out of them, maybe sneak into the tournament and what have you, you know, building it around defense, which failed them this weekend. But when you look at that, they have these kind of starting pitching numbers, and they haven't really been great so far. They haven't felt great. I mean, Senga's been really good with his velocity on his fastball. I mean, Clay Holmes is a ground ball machine. Their best pitcher, maybe arguably McLean, has admittedly not been great. Freddy Peralta has been as advertised. David Peterson's giving you a good start, bad start, what you would expect, and he's in the appropriate role as the fifth starter. We'll see if they actually use a sixth starter. Manaea right now doesn't look like he can navigate a lineup a couple of times. As a matter of fact, Manaea is looking like a guy that is going to eat innings this year right now. You know, maybe help during a doubleheader, maybe piggyback, but not somebody I think that right now looks like he can make a start or is worth sacrificing a Peralta, McLean, a Holmes, or a Senga start at this point. Maybe the biggest change in this rotation has been Senga, who I've been critical of. I think the extra velocity has helped him, as you could see just today against San Francisco, not being able to catch up to that fastball. It's a weapon that I think makes his Ghost Forked even that much more valuable. He can blow a fastball by a hitter when he needs to. That's big. And the 3 miles an hour, that's big. Now, it's not quite the 99 that it was in start one. I mean, but 96, 97 is plenty. That's 3 or 4 miles an hour more than what he normally throws. Let's see how he holds up over the course of the season. Best news today on regular rest. There he is, pitching well. I think the Mets, after April, once they get all these early season days off out of the way, how will they play that? Will they spot a Manaea start? Will they spot maybe a piggyback with Tobias Myers to give everybody an extra day? I could see that. I think they're going to be strategic and they're going to be smart about that. So you got to love, and this is the biggest difference. If the starting pitching in the bullpen, and we know they're not going to be perfect or they're not going to be on all year, you know they're going to have their peaks and valleys. Well, every rotation does. But if they're trending towards being a top 10 staff on both the bullpen and the starters, that is going to be the biggest difference. And it's going to be a big difference from even the team that went to the NLCS in 2024 that had trouble in the bullpen. The starting pitching didn't come on until late in the year. And if you remember, when they made their run and they got to September and they played over 600 ball in September, it was because the starting pitching, led by Manaea, actually was able to carry their load. On offense, they've broken out the last two or three games. No Lindor, no contributions from Lindor. Soto out. Bichette is starting to show you why he might be a little bit of a different feel in that lineup than what Alonso gave you. Polanco, even though he's been a little gimpy with the Achilles early in the year, a big hit today. They haven't even really gotten going. I mean, think about it here. On offense, the Mets, and I think that this is, again, really ridiculous small sample size. I mean, everybody talks about the Yankees and the Yankees' offense, which is good. I mean, the Mets' runs created are actually higher than the Yankees. The Mets are a top 10 offensive team. Granted, again, the last two or three games in San Francisco have gone a long way. But if they're going to average 4.8 to 5 runs per game like they are right now, and remember, the way that baseball is, everything evens out. You could go into St. Louis and score bupkis. I mean, they scored the last two games in between the extra inning game and the second game in St. Louis, they scored one run. They scored 5 runs in 3 games. They were outscored 7-5 in 3 games in that series. I mean, this stuff all evens out at the end of the day. So, you know, I think that is, you know, what you see so far is kind of where maybe they'll land. I mean, if they're 4.8, 4.9, 5 runs per game, that's going to be plenty when you talk about a staff that looks very promising. And those are reasons alone to feel good about this club, who's 6-4. I know some of you are going to say, Mike, they should be 7-3, 8-2. They should have won against Pittsburgh in the final game of that series. They should have won against the Cardinals. That business person special in game three. Perhaps, I can't argue with that, but you could argue maybe they shouldn't have won today. I mean, they were able to, do just enough. What I like about the offense is that they are putting pressure on the pitcher. They're making contact. They're going the other way. They're doing a lot of different things that they hadn't been doing, I think, over the last couple of years. And I'll tell you the big story on offense right now. It's going to be the component. And that's going to be the real difference maker. We all know at the end of the year, presuming they're healthy, Lindor, Bichette, and Soto are going to be who they're going to be. And I think Polanco, who's a veteran, who's not an over-the-hill veteran, he's only 32 years old, he should be able to produce equivalent to what he did in Seattle last year as a good component player. What it's going to come down to is Luis Robert Jr. for real? Is Brett Beatty a contributor? Is he for real? Is Francisco Alvarez and the power we've seen, is he for real? Can he be a Piazza light in terms of his power at the plate and maybe improve a skush on his defense, which sometimes still comes and goes? But I think the real difference maker and a guy that, look, he's been through the gauntlet here. If there's anybody that's been through the gauntlet as a Met, it's Mark Vientos. I've been critical of him. I mean, let's face it, it came out the Mets were willing to give him to Chicago in the Luis Robert Jr. deal. They wound up having their choice of Vientos and Acuna, and they took Acuna. Think about how far Vientos has fallen. I mean, after the playoff series in 2024, if any team like the White Sox were offered Vientos for for a Luis Robert Jr., I think 10 times out of 10 they'd take Vientos. But he showed to be a one-dimensional bat who's a DH. But the last few days at first base, he's shown some decent aptitude. Now, I still think he should have caught that ball that Brazenban had thrown that wound up being an out because of the interference. And that was, I think that was a good call. It was kind of a cheap call because I think that he should, if he just ran in inside the line, it would have just, wouldn't have been a big deal. He would have been in the same spot, and Vientos probably still drops it. And then it's just a matter of interpretation of the rule. But other than that play, I mean, he's looked pretty good at first base. He's made a couple of real nice stops on hard hit balls. He doesn't look uncomfortable. We haven't seen him with any tough picks, so there's still a lot to be desired here. There's still a lot to see, but very well he can potentially be a solution there. And I dare say, with his production, I'm not saying he's going to be Pete Alonso. He's not going to hit 35 homers and 120 RBIs year in and year out. He's never produced consistently like that. But there's no reason why every day at first base, if his defense is adequate, he can't hit 25 to 30 home runs, driving 80 to 90 runs. That's plenty, and that's a really productive first baseman and somebody who is handling the position. I mean, that would be huge for this lineup. It would lengthen the lineup. And again, and I said this over at Extra Innings early in the week, that's going to be the big difference on offense between 2025 and 2026. That's what's going to be the difference. These component kids, these young players with high potential. Not Marcus Semien, who is a veteran, who's there for his glove, and who's at the bottom of the lineup, who is expected to do what he did today, tack on like he hit a home run the other day. He's not expected to carry the offense. Everyone's going to pick on Semien. Oh, he's washed. He's this. We'll see. But Simeon's not there to be a core offensive player. That's not who he is anymore. It's not like when he signed with Toronto as a free agent. I think that Luis Robert and Vientos are the two that really could be interesting and really lengthen this lineup. And for some reason, I still wonder if, and he got three hits today, Jared Young, somebody who's been a 4A guy throughout his career, who has, if you look at Jared Young, he's got an .813 OPS in the minors over eight seasons. He hasn't been a bad minor league hitter. And if you look at his resume here, he was drafted by the Cubs in the 15th round. He came up through the Cubs system. He's a guy that in the minor leagues has had some power. He's had some really good power years. He hit 21 home runs at Iowa in 2023. Went to Korea, had seemed to have a really renaissance there. But who knows, as a lefty bat with Talkman out, I know Tommy Pham is in the system now. The Mets with Ben struggling, and that's, I think that's the one name that we haven't brought up, and I would caution about that. Let's give the kid a month. I think you give him April to figure things out. He's still a guy that provides you some value on defense, but at this point, you know, you got Taylor who could spot him against tough lefty. If Ben continues to hit significantly below the Mendoza line, I mean, he at least deserves Jared Young a start in right field. I mean, he showed a pretty good arm today and left on the double when he threw, and I can't remember who on the Giants he threw out at second base. I think it was Encarnacion, if I'm not mistaken. But, I mean, Jared Young, you know, maybe there's finally everything has been brought together here, and, you know, he can be a contributor. So up and down the lineup, and, you know, with Torrens and what he does as a backup, Taylor with the home run and with the defense, you know, maybe Taylor could be more comfortable in a backup role. Jared Young, Vientos, really, right, the only name right now that you could really be concerned about is Benj. And, I mean, it's his first 30 plate appearances in the big leagues going into the day. He's got 32, 33 plate appearances. I'm not ready to write him off. I will say it'll be interesting if he continues to struggle, the conversation that the front office is going to have towards the end of April. They very well may give him a left leash until Memorial Day when you think a Talkman would be back and available. I don't know what Tommy Pham's situation on the opt-out is, so that'll be another thing to look at. But after everything, and this team has not been perfect, it's not like every game has been the blueprint for them to go out there and, you know, say, okay, this is how we win. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff going on, starters not being perfect. I mean, even Devin Williams was shaky, I thought, in the ninth inning today. He was helped out by a bad play by Chapman running. He should not be trying to steal a base down by three runs. Torrens throwing him out. You know, he wound up battling and getting through it, but it was a little bit dicey there. He bended, but he did not break. And I think that shows that just like how Diaz used to be sometimes, the great closers, even though they're best stuff, can navigate and get through it. So take a deep breath. Day off on Monday. The Mets are, you know, off to a decent start. If you had told me all the things that have gone on, the tough couple of tough losses, you know, some of the pitchers not being perfect, you know, like McClain, the injury to Soto, Lindor off to an awful start, Bichette off to an awful start. You would not expect the Mets to be playing 600 baseball right now, but they are. So maybe it's partly because of the competition, but going to San Francisco, look, anytime you have a road trip and you play as poorly as they did, especially on the offensive side in St. Louis, then you head to San Francisco, not a hitter's ballpark, and then you go out there and you put up 20-something runs in three games. I mean, that's not common. That's not a ballpark. That's the ballpark where you expect to have four sleepy games and frustrating losses and balls dying at the warning track. You know, not like Tyrone Taylor's home run going over the wall or what have you. So, you know, we'll see. So when we come back, we'll get to the mailbag and see what some of the commentary is from you guys. 10 games in here. Mets are not the 2025 Mets. They're the 2026 Mets. Feel better. Take a deep breath. Not to say that some of the things that are concerning you aren't concerns, but at least for one night or one day off, you could feel pretty good heading into the homestand starting off against Arizona. And then old friend Jeff McNeil comes back next weekend when the A's visit town. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. Let's get to the mailbag here. I wanted to start out a little bit different with some different topics. First one was from Sean about the ABS system, balls and strikes. He wrote, hey, Mike, I wanted to hear your thoughts on ABS. Overall, I've liked it. It's overturned some egregious calls, and I do think I agree with Gary that it's making the umps focus more. I actually agree with that. I think the umps have, as you watch the game, and I told you I watched a game a while back from 1999, a Rick Reed shutout late in the year against the Pirates, that final weekend of the season. And the strike zone is carnival. I mean, so, and look, it went the Mets' way, but I mean, Piazza's setting up, 3 inches outside the strike zone. Reed's hitting the glove, strike three. I mean, probably, God only knows what ABS would have been like with some of the calls that night. But Sean wants to do a counterpoint, and he thinks there's a flaw to it. I don't like it overturning a call when a ball is moving out of the zone, such as the slide or a curve, and a tiny amount of the ball, like 2%, catches the zone. I think that's unintentionally expanding the strike zone on the pitches with excessive movement. Anyways, I'd like to hear your thoughts. So here's the thing, Sean. I understand your point of view. And to be fair to the umpires, when I see a ball hit or miss by like that bottom of the box, like it just ticks it, or like they miss, I think today one of the balls that the Giants challenged, I don't know if it was Senga or it was Luke Weaver, I couldn't remember who it was. I think it was Senga. I mean, it was literally 0.2 inches away from the zone. I mean, from the human eye, it would be very hard to ascertain, especially with the velocity of the movement. I think if you're going to use the system, you got to use the system for the way it is. You get two challenges. And remember, there's a strategy to this. Just because it seems obvious because the ABS says it ticked the zone, the catcher or the pitcher or the batter has to be able to feel confident enough with their quick decision tree that it's worth challenging. And right now, I think there were stats. The catchers are far and away the best at this. I haven't gotten an update on that, but I think the pitchers were the worst, but the catchers were the best, and the batters were somewhere in between. Makes sense. I mean, the catchers are there behind the plate. They see the movement. They know best. When a catcher complains about balls and strikes, for the most part, you should listen at that point. Do I think that it's going to cause a problem in terms of the drama of a game? 3-2, bases loaded, tie game, ball four, walking around, wait, tap of the helmet, oh, that's strike three, you're out, or, you know, World Series game or playoff game. It could. It's no different than replay where umpire calls everybody out, close bang bang play, everybody celebrates, oh, wait, hold up, replay, let's go to Secaucus. That takes time. I think this ABS is quick. It's a quick tap of the hat, they turn around, it goes up on the screen, bam, it's done. I was not for any of this. When I first heard that there was going to be what they used to call robot umpires, I'm like, hey, this is ridiculous. You know, you're taking away the human element of the game. You're taking away the craft of umpiring a game. But I think uniformity of the strike zone has been something that's been lacking in the game for a long time. I know it added character, like in the old days, because of the chest protector. The American League used to always call higher strikes than the National League. The American League had their zone. This umpire had their zone. I mean, everybody remembers the late Eric Gregg and his ridiculous strike zone from that 97 playoff game between Miami and Atlanta. I think the best baseball is the one where it's the most accurate, where the umpire calls it like it's written in the rule book, which it looks like that's what they've finally done. I mean, to the point where guys are shrinking, their heights are shrinking because they need to be able to have a zone for them that the technology can actually call the strikes and all the balls and strikes appropriately. I don't see anything wrong with it. Do I think we'll get to a world where the umpire just sits behind home plate and hears ball strike? I wouldn't be surprised. Now, I don't want to do that because I think that if the technology breaks down, you're going to need an umpire that's still, it's like running a marathon. You can't just sit on your butt and then expect to run a marathon. You know, that's just not going to happen. And I don't think that that's the case, but I do think there's going to be a time where I think the umpire is just going to, it's going to be overturned automatically. I don't think it's even going to be a challenge from a hitter. They're going to use the technology as gospel. And if you feel the technology is accurate, I got to think it is. Now, I've always said on instant replay that I didn't think the spirit of instant replay was the finger that didn't touch second base on a bang-bang play. That's the spirit of replay. I think that that's what Sean's saying here in terms of the ABS. I think the ABS is a little more cut and dry because it's either going to hit the zone or not. It's no different than if you played, and maybe some of you in the audience don't know this, but back in the day when we used to play stickball or wiffle ball or, you know, sponge ball, whatever you want to call, when you didn't have access to hardball, when you were an organized league, you usually drew a strike zone on the back of the schoolyard wall. And if it hit anywhere in that strike zone, including the bottom part of the box, it was a strike. Basically, this is the high-level, you know, technologically advanced version of the box in the schoolyard. So some of you might appreciate that. Some of you in the audience might think I'm out of my mind and dating myself, but so be it. Joe Favorito, who, long-term... He's over on X at Joe Fav. Know Joe for a while. Professor over at Columbia University. Worked in sports and public relations a long time. Consultant. Actually tweeted at me during the game today. And it's something that I think is going to have to be discussed because I think it's becoming more reality. He wrote, "If Keith and Ron are stepping aside after this season, I love the work of my old friend Todd Zeal, how he's doing in the SNY booth. He and Daniel Murphy would be a great additions." Murph is a real informative booth addition. I don't think he has the personality, and to a certain degree, I think Zeal's personality is probably going to be more aligned with Keith and Ron. I do think we all have to start to wonder with Keith's health. You know, he had to basically tap out of the San Francisco series. You know that he's really hurting because that's his hometown because of his back issues. You know, Ron is doing some national games. I even think Gary, and people pointed this out over on X, that Gary's lost a little bit of his fastball with calling home runs and maybe missing some pitches. I lived through the late career of Ralph Kiner and Bob Murphy. Bob Murphy got rough there those last two or three years. Ralph obviously had health issues. He got rough later in his career when they brought him back in the early days of SNY, when, you know, early days of Keith and Ron as like a in between the game guest. It was interesting to hear him tell stories. I think that's what you like about Keith and Ron. Gary is a play-by-play guy. I don't know if he's at the point like Howie Rose where he wants to maybe hang it up. I have to say, out of all of them, I think Howie still has it. You know, Howie's probably getting out early, and he's still very much, I think, every bit as good as he's always been. But I think, and we talked about this when Keith Rad was on right before the season, we have been blessed covering the Mets, following the Mets, fans of the Mets, with incredible, incredible booths. From Lindsey Nelson, Ralph Kiner, Bob Murphy, to Tim McCarver and Steve Zabriskie and Ralph Kiner, Gary, Keith, and Ron, Howie Rose. I mean, I even think Fran Healy wasn't horrible. He was a very nice man. I had a chance to talk to him a little bit when he was still doing some stuff with MSG. We have been blessed with great booths, and it's going to be really hard to replace them. I think Zeal's an interesting option. Murphy is an interesting option. I'd love to see if we could get David Cone over, if that ever happened, from the Bronx, but I think at this point, Cone, even though he grew up with the Mets and maybe statistically had some of his better years with the Mets, I think he's more remembered as a Yankee. Even though if you look at it, probably down the middle statistically, won more championships with the Yankees, didn't win with the Mets, came after the 86 championship. But I'll tell you this much, it's going to be big shoes to fill. And I have to agree with you, Joe. I don't know if you're listening, but I thought Zeal did an excellent job this weekend. I think he showed his personality, and he might be somebody that is going to be spending more time in the booth and potentially be called upon as Keith and Ron start to maybe age out a little bit, which is crazy to think about, really crazy to think about. So what else do we have here? Let's see. Steve, here he wrote, "It's been a very stressful start to the season. While it's still early, there's a lot of adversity to face and several tough pills to swallow. The fan base is unfortunately returning to toxic behavior, and I'm finding that Mendoza's quotes and demeanor don't inspire much confidence. On the field, the team simply isn't hitting. Seeing bat speeds down for players like Bichette and Semien combined with Polanco's nagging Achilles injury is concerning. Our pitching situation is equally uncertain with Senga's return and Peterson looking shaky. Even looking toward the farm system, seeing the bad debuts from Tong, Scott, and Watson is discouraging, especially when you see teams like the Tigers and Pirates calling up superstar prospects like Griffin and McGonagall, who are 19 and 21. We haven't had that kind of positional player homegrown excitement since Wright and Reyes. It's also frustrating to see the Yankees having more success across town, yet again, even after we took Soto from them. Given the resources available in year three, I can't help but wonder if it's fair to question whether Stern should have put together a better roster than what we currently have. Looking at the Marlins, they have a much better record over the last 100 games, despite having far fewer resources. I really hope that begins to turn around soon." Well, look, Steve, I don't know if the last three games changes this. He wrote this on Friday right before the Mets were to take on the Giants. So this is before the three-game winning streak. I think everything that you're talking about is fair. I think, again, it's very early to get crazy over small sample sizes. I think what Steve is talking about here is the PTSD from last year's second half. This is one of the years where the Mets have to get off to a good start, to Steve's point, to ward off the toxic behavior from the fan base. And I'm not going to get into lecturing you about the fans. I get into myself into trouble all the time with that. My advice to you is this. The toxic nature of the fan base on social media is not going to change. Whether it's an age group, a mindset, whatever it is, it's not going to change. Battling it and responding to it and trying to sell them on changing is a waste of time. What you should do is what I did, is get away from it for a couple of days. If it's on X, I know you don't want to not see content. Mute certain people. Mute certain topics. Enjoy baseball. The one thing I really want to do as I get older here, and I'm 49, I'm going to be 50 in January, so I'm getting to be a little bit long in the tooth. Still young, but a little long in the tooth. I want to start enjoying the nuance of the game. I want to get back to enjoying the game for the game. I think that at times, and part of that might be what I'm doing here, is the numbers and the media and the Yankee situation and all this stuff. It just becomes almost like a win is relieving, a loss is the end of the world. When they win, you're never satisfied because they didn't win the right way. And I think that's something I've talked about before, where analytics and information and process versus outcome, which are all wonderful things that allow you to understand why a team is doing well or not well, or why a team might be a little over-indexed, or why that they're lucky and where their luck might run out. It really clarifies a team to you. But what it takes away is the excitement and the wonder. Maybe a little bit of that, what I criticize, is the amazing and believe component of a season, where even in the face of statistical certainty, you always used to believe back in the day, because we didn't have all this information, that your team had a shot to win. If this happened, if that happened, if they get into a close game, you know, with all the data now, it's almost like cold water's thrown in your face any time you want to wonder about, hey, why can't my team be that team? Why can't my team win a championship? So, you know, the Yankee thing with Cam Schittler, and I know tonight I was seeing some stuff on social media where they were saying blank Juan Soto at Yankee Stadium. It's a fan base that is never going to get off Soto leaving them for the Mets. That's going to be something that's going to follow Soto probably for the rest of his career. It's a fan base that is clearly threatened by Cohen and the Mets. It's a fan base that hasn't won in a while. They haven't won in 17 years, and that's pissing them off. Because a generation of fans that saw four World Series in 5 years, and then with a little drought between 2000 and 2009, saw another one, doesn't remember 1977, 78, and how they didn't win anything until 95. Why the Yankees became special again in 95, and why they overtook the city and captured the magic of the city, is that the city was reeling a little bit from the disappointment of how the Mets fizzled out. And I think it was a long time in the Bronx where there was meaningful baseball. And I think that this fan base is not used to that. They grew up and they were introduced to the sport probably when that was all happening. So that was normal to them. And I'm as guilty of it as anybody else. I get online, I pick fights with Yankee fans and Yankee accounts, and you know, I have to make snarky comments, especially with these the goofy trade rumors and the obsession over Skeens. Now, when Jim Bowden over at MLB Network Radio acts like a fanboy Yankee fan making crazy proposals for Paul Skeens going to the Yankees, it's like I'm addicted. I can't not say anything, but ignore it. The Yankees shouldn't matter to you until they play the Mets in May, and then they play the Mets again in September. And truthfully, if things are going to turn out the way I think they're going to turn out, there might be some juice in this Subway Series. I mean, imagine a McLean Schittler, and I'm probably saying his name wrong. Am I going to have to get bleeped on Cam Schittler? Schlittler. People are going to get on my case about Schlittler. I didn't mean to say it. Cam Schlittler, right? Oh boy, I got that one. That was a Freudian Schlittler, not Schittler. Maybe you guys like that I said Schlittler. Schlittler. All right, bleep it out. If there's anybody in the car with their kids, I apologize on that. But at the end of the day, it'll be fun. I mean, the kid ace versus the other kid ace. Soto returns to the Bronx, maybe a little bit more relaxed than he was a year ago when he came in May. who knows, this new group of Mets, the Bichettes of the world, Polanco, they're experiencing the Subway Series for the first time, Weaver coming over, Devin Williams, I got to tell you, if he comes in for a save, he's going to hear it from the Bronx crowd. It might be fun. There was nothing more fun than those Subway Series in the 90s. And I really think that I miss them to a certain degree. Granted, I don't necessarily want to see the Yankees go back to where they are. They got a good team. Just like it's early for the Mets, it's early for them. They're not going to score a billion runs, and they're not going to go through series not giving up any runs, just like the Mets are not going to score 10 runs a game, so like they have over the last couple of games. As far as the farm system and the debuts, I know Tong and Scott and Watson all got hit pretty hard. Remember, Scott's coming back from a serious injury. Tong is going through some development stuff. Look at today during the game, JT Brubaker. Now, JT Brubaker, the reason I bring him up is he was drafted in the sixth round by the Pirates. He was a huge prospect, if I'm not mistaken. And if I go back to the Pirates' top prospects, and if you go back, and I'm pretty sure, if you go back to 2020, I'm almost positive he was like a top prospect here. And I guess I'm going to go back to 2019 here. I'm trying to find him here. I almost feel like he was a top prospect. And, I mean, wouldn't be the first guy to, you know, fizzle out. I mean, look at, I'll just go back, top 100, 2019. Victor Robles was a top five prospect. You know, not really. Eloy Jimenez, he's fizzled out. Bo Bichette was 11th overall at that point. You know, Joe Adele, we just saw that. Mackenzie Gore. I mean, there's some guys who have you know, really lived up. But, you know, you look just a couple of years later, Jared Kelnick, perfect example. Sometimes they just don't work out. I mean, that's the thing. That's why they're prospects. And I think, this is one of my predictions, the Mets are going to have a tough decision come the deadline, because I think there's going to be some good players available that they can add to the roster to get themselves in a position to maybe win a championship. And they may have to give up a painful prospect package to do it. And that's something that it'll be an interesting debate when the time comes. So, you know, we'll see. Let's keep going through this. Let's see a couple more. James writes, Mendy is an idiot. He wrote this the other day. He puts Vientos in against the righty the night before he plays against the lefty. Correct call. Why can't Beatty play at the same time as Vientos? I see no reason why Vientos is a glove, but okay, play him at first, but play Beatty too. Simeon, to me, should be a guy that sits. If he's going to hit 220, that's who he is now. That doesn't equal a full-time job even with the gold glove. I disagree with that, James. I think give Simeon some time to round to form. I think the defense up the middle is big. I think he's bad at the bottom of the lineup. If the lineup is not everybody slumping, I don't think you're going to care about the bat. Mendy has no idea how to run the team. He's terrible already running Love Lady out there like he's had. And enough with this BS, guys, that aren't available. It's six games. That frustrating about how, and I think, James, thanks for the rant. They have a plan. They have a plan of rest. I saw even Wardy over there on social media complaining about Alvarez sitting after he hit a couple of home runs. They are going to put their guys into rest. They're going to play the long game. Baseball's not like football. They're not going to go all out to win a game today. They're going to play the long game. I was talking to somebody in baseball earlier in the week who made a point that back in the day, Tommy Lasorda used to just play to win at all cost every game, which is an old school mindset, which is pretty much what James is talking about. And it hurt his bullpen. Hurt his starters. I mean, Fernando Valenzuela basically threw out his shoulder because of how many innings he pitched early in his career. Go up and down some Dodger bullpens back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s when bullpens became the rage. Look at how Tommy just ran some of these guys ragged because he played at all cost to win the game. And that is something that you have to do, but you have to realize that these are assets and resources that need to be there in August and September. And right now, and I think that the question is, can they get somebody better than Lovelady that could eat those innings when they're down 2-3-0 so that maybe those games don't get out of hand where they can't be a comeback? But I think that that's what you're seeing from Mendoza. It was interesting. I think it was Kai Correa that recommended him pinch hitting for Luis Torrens. Turned out to be a good call. Wound up losing the DH, which would have been interesting if the pitcher spot came up. And I think when he did the double switch, he took Alvarez out of the ninth spot, kept Torrens in to catch, which was the right call. So if that game had been tied, what would the Mets have done? Now, they had Beatty on the bench. I don't know if Beatty was available to hit. They probably could have used him to hit. But would they have used McClain as a hitter? Would they have bunted? Like, it would have been interesting to see. So I think that the new coaching staff is probably going to help Mendoza. I don't think Mendoza is a bad manager. And I'll go back to something that Steve wrote. You know, the comments are bothering him. Because what do you want him to say after the game? I mean, he's not going to go out there and I heard somebody, I think it was somebody wrote on social media, well, Terry Collins would yell and scream and fire them up. Terry Collins was a fake. I hate to break it to you guys. He was a fake tough guy. He was basically a placeholder manager that got lucky. Along with Sandy Alderson, 2015, they got lucky. He had basically 16 good weeks of baseball in 15 and 16 that saved him from having the most meaningless manager of the career. I don't think he was all that hard on the players. I think he was better at putting a persona entertaining the fans and the media, which Mendoza is not good at entertaining. Mendoza is good at managing the media and giving them enough. What he's doing and what ultimately will be about his, whether he survives past this year without he doesn't have a contract and gets an extension or gets let go. It'll be whether or not he manages that clubhouse, how he collaborates with the front office. I had seen something floating around from one of the Baseball America guys that Cohen wanted to fire him and Stearns had to convince him not to. I don't know if that's true. And at this day and age, I don't know if there's a Tony La Russa, Buck Showalter, a Davey Johnson, a Tommy Lasorda, like a big-name manager that you could bring in that could change things or bring these guys to the next level. There is one guy that has a history of doing it, but I think he's past that prime, and that's Dusty Baker. Anytime he's come in, he's immediately done something like that. I don't know if he has a Jack McKeon, one last hurrah. So if you told me, hey, bring a name up of an old school manager, and I don't know if the Mets would even contemplate that. I don't know if Dusty wants to get into the grind again. That'd be Dusty Baker. That'd be the guy. If you told me, need someone to spark this thing and you want to win now. I mean, he did it in San Francisco. He did it in Chicago before that awful collapse of what happened in 2003 with Alou and Bartman. He did it when he went to Cincinnati for a brief time. Washington, D.C., he did it. Houston, under extremely adverse conditions with the sign stealing, he did it. So to me, that's part of it. All right, let's do one more. And if I didn't get to you, I apologize. Just keep sending it over. Andy Pizarro, this is after the St. Louis game. I'm infuriated. The only players who are currently swinging the bat well are Soto, Polanco, and Robert. In my view, this does not look like a team that is playing hard for the manager. Furthermore, committing $50 million to Semien and Manaea seems like a horrible use of resources. I'm starting to question the perception of Stearns matches the reality. This team isn't as good as we'd like it to be, and there's simply too much dead weight and too many question marks on the roster. I'm still waiting for the day that we finally become the Dodgers of the East Coast. I'm tired of years of underachieving. When will it end? Andy just wrote, and again, he wrote this after the St. Louis series, and I'm going back, but it's what I told you. Money is only going to get you to the table and plug or mitigate some of the mistakes. You have to continue to build a farm system of player development. Fair point made earlier in the show. Look at Connor Griffin and McGonigal from Detroit. These are superstar positional players. Mets haven't had those kind of exciting players since Reyes and Wright. That's correct. I don't know if Benj is that guy. He's certainly not showing it here early on. I'll tell you what, and I said this again, and he off to a decent start, I believe, the other day. I think he got a few hits. I think A.J. Ewing is going to be that guy. I just something about A.J. Ewing. I think he might be better than Benj. I think he's a guy that may be called up mid-season to get a little jolt of energy to this club. Maybe he takes over in right field. It'll be interesting to see. We'll see what happens with the pitchers. I mean, they struck gold with McClain. So far, that's it. The other guys haven't really proven anything. I think if anybody's going to get a shot before the year is out, it might be Christian Scott if he could stay healthy and build himself up. Keep in mind, it takes pitchers a long time to develop too, Andy. And I think that's where patience is. I know that you're year five or six into Cohen. But I think that the first two or three years of Cohen, not that they don't count, he was trying to figure out how to run an organization in this crazy sport. Had Sandy Alderson there, which was a waste. He couldn't get access to a big-time executive for a variety of reasons. Stearns didn't come in until 2024. He's really only on year like three, I would say, of everything normalized. I think the first 3 years was kind of like organized chaos in some ways. And they had a 101-win season in the middle and had some fun moments. I mean, think about it. Most organizations, most people who took over would have ripped the thing down to the studs and said, done a marketing campaign and a promise of tomorrow. He's still to a certain degree. Everybody's promising a better tomorrow and a more sustainable infrastructure for tomorrow. But they're trying to have some fun and win now. And I think that to a certain degree, doing some of that stuff, which is what a lot of fans remember with the Javier Baez, Pete Carl Armstrong trade, maybe hurt them in the long run. But it was the right thing to do for a fan base that really needed that. So I'm sure there's a lot more. I apologize if I didn't get to you, but I thought that was a good way to end. It was a kind of a theme in the notes this week, the commentary and all that stuff. So, hey, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G. Send me your comments. You could send me a tweet if it's one that I could, you know, really stands out. I usually save it and talk about it. Obviously, you could go to TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Love to hear from you guys. And if you're not a paid subscriber yet, less than a cup of coffee a month, two to three times a week, I have been doing a lot of audio content, maybe written content. I want to look this week at the back of the bullpen, see if there's some arms emerging down in this early season of AAA that maybe could replace Dick Lovelady, who seems to be giving up at least a run and outing. Mets back home playing Arizona, Jeff McNeil coming back into town. So there might be some interesting storylines this week. Just stay tuned and we'll continue to, this journey here, early season journey of the 2026 Mets. So, but take a deep breath. Take some time off. Okay, it's been a rough week. The Yankee stuff, the tough series in St. Louis, the early struggles with some of the new players, the Mendoza stuff, the toxic fan base, a lot thrown at the Met fans this last 7 to 10 days to start the season. And guess what? They're on a 97-win pace, so take a deep breath. Things are not as bad as maybe you think. So, all right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And come join me at the new and improved talkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free. Premium content, updates on the show, and of course, you could even send me a note all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.